anybody, right? I'm curious how come you drove all the way from Broward County to check up on him. Is he what you call under investigation? The detective had no intention of telling Red Hammernut the truth, that he was fishing for leads in a possible homicide, that he had nothing better to do than track down some dumb gorilla who seemed to be surveilling his prime suspect, that he needed an excuse to get out of the office anyway before Captain Gallo tossed a new case in his lap. "No, but you're right. Normally this is worth a phone call," Rolvag said, "or even a fax. But some of the folks who live in that neighborhood where Mr. O'Toole was seen, how can I put this? They've been very loyal supporters of our sheriff.
Meaning they give serious bucks to his re-election campaigns," Hammernut cut in. "So when they got a problem, the sheriff, he takes a personal interest. Right?"
"I'm glad you understand." Rolvag let his gaze wander appreciatively across the photographs on the wall. "I had a feeling you would." Hammernut smiled sagely.
"Works the same way everywhere, don't it? Politics, I mean."
The detective smiled back. "Anyway, I'm supposed to make sure this O'Toole character isn't some sort of serial killer waiting to pounce on unsuspecting Republican housewives." Another cataclysmic sneeze erupted from Hammernut, who swabbed daintily at his florid nose.
"You go on home and tell your sheriff not to worry about old Earl Edward whatever. He won't bother nobody. I'll see to it."
Rolvag put away his notebook and rose to leave. He considered tossing out the name of Charles Perrone to see what reaction it might elicit, but he changed his mind. Red Hammernut was too sharp to admit having a connection to the scientist, if there was one. The detective said, "You can prosecute Mr. O'Toole for using that credit card."
"I could do that. I could get him some, whatchacallit, private counseling."
Red Hammernut winked.
"Big and hairy as he is, I got some boys even bigger and hairier. Know what I mean?"
The detective had not mentioned O'Toole's startling pelt, which meant that Hammernut plainly remembered the man more clearly than he'd let on. At the door, the bantam tycoon slapped a hand on Rolvag's shoulder and asked if he wanted to take home a crate of fresh-picked escarole. Rolvag said leafy greens gave him indigestion, but he thanked Hammernut just the same. Driving back toward the highway, the detective swerved to miss a baby snake that was sunning itself on the gravel. It was a speckled king, the size of a child's necklace. And right away the detective noticed it was grossly deformed. The snake had been born with only one eye, and on the ebony tip of its nose was a growth the size of an acorn. Rolvag knew it probably wouldn't survive much longer, but he released it in a nearby grove anyway. Thinking, poor little guy. What a lousy roll of the dice he got. Red Hammernut remembered the day he first met Charles Perrone. Lisbeth had fluttered into his office saying there was a young man wanting to see him about a job. A persistent young man, she'd said, wouldn't speak to anybody but the boss himself. Red Hammernut's first impulse was to call security and have the impertinent punk heaved off the property. But then he glanced at the man's resume and said, "What the hell? Give him 5 minutes." Red Hammernut was curious to know why anybody with a master's degree in marine biology was so keen on working for a vegetable farm. Chaz Perrone walked in wearing a blue blazer, tan trousers, and a club tie. He pumped Red Hammernut's hand, installed himself on the other side of the desk, and started yakking like he was pushing timeshares. His cockiness was so annoying that Red Hammernut couldn't help interrupting now and then with a belch. But after a while, the young man started making a certain amount of sense. Perrone opened a file and took out a recent newspaper clipping that Red glumly recognized. The headline reading, "Local Farm Cited as Glades Polluter." The article was about a series of water samples taken downstream from Red Hammernut's vegetable operation. Phosphorus had been measured in suspension at 302 parts per billion, nearly 30 times higher than the legal limit for runoff into the Everglades. By itself, Hammernut Farms was flushing more fertilizer per gallon into South Florida's water
than the state's largest cattle ranch and sugarcane grower combined. An act of pollution so egregious that even Red Hammernut's powerful cronies in Washington dared not intercede. It was Chaz Perrone's opinion that Hammernut Farms would continue to face harsh scrutiny from regulatory agencies as well as the news media, which is why he was generously offering his services as an environmental consultant. When Red Hammernut pointed out that Perrone had no background whatsoever in agricultural waste treatment, Chaz replied that he was a quick learner. He described his experience defending his current employer, a renowned cosmetics firm, against charges that their products contained carcinogens and industrial corrosives. Proudly, he recalled the time that his testimony had cast critical doubt upon that of a female plaintiff whose cheekbones had mysteriously delaminated after an application of designer blush. Chaz asserted it was important for corporations to have their own experts, people who could credibly challenge accusers on points of science, or at least muddle the debate. Red Hammernut liked Chaz Perrone's attitude. It was a pleasure to encounter a young biologist so unfettered by idealism, so unabashedly sympathetic to the needs of private enterprise. Moreover, Chaz wasn't nerdy and soft-spoken like some of the scientists Red Hammernut had hired in the past. He was sharp-looking and glib, and would come across credibly on TV. Unfortunately, a master's degree in sea lice wouldn't cut it. "You need a Ph.D. on swamps and such," Red Hammernut had informed Chaz, "else these enviro is going to eat you for breakfast." And so it unfolded that Charles Regis Perrone was enrolled in a doctoral program at Duke University's Wetland Center. His improbable acceptance at such a lofty institution coincided with a substantial cash endowment from Mr. S.J. Hammernut, who also happened to be paying Chaz's tuition. Red Hammernut guessed correctly that, being in the heart of tobacco country, Duke would have no qualms about accepting phosphorus-tainted farm dollars. Unlike during his stay at the University of Miami, Chaz Perrone required no whip-cracking on his quest for a Ph.D. Although he didn't distinguish himself academically at Duke, he didn't embarrass himself either. This time he was self-motivated. This time he smelled real money down the line. Upon graduation, he expected to be presented with a lucrative consulting contract for Hammernut Farms. But Red had other plans. After pulling a few strings, he landed Chaz a gig as a state biologist, testing water purity in a particular sector of the Everglades agricultural area. The young biologist was profoundly disappointed. But Red assured him that a six-figure position and an air-conditioned office awaited if he proved himself in the field. And that Chaz was doing. Less than 6 weeks after he took the job, phosphorus levels in the runoff from Hammernut Farms were recorded at 150 parts per billion, a startling reduction of more than 50%. 2 months later, the figure dropped to 78 ppb. 6 months after that, field survey showed the phosphorus discharge holding steady at about 9 ppb, a level so low that regulators removed Hammernut Farms from their target list of outlaw polluters. The local Sierra Club even gave a plaque to Red Hammernut and planted a cypress seedling in his honor. Red was pleased by the positive publicity, and he was glad to get those goddamn tree huggers off his case. More important to the bottom line, however, was that the fictitious phosphorus readings allowed Red Hammernut to escape the costly inconveniences being imposed on his neighbors in the name of wetlands restoration. Unlike other farms in the area, Red's operation wasn't forced to cut back on the potent amounts of fertilizer it was dumping on crops, for example, or made to spend millions building filtration ponds to strain out the phosphate crud. Thanks to the innovative fieldwork of Dr. Charles Perrone, Hammernut Farms could continue using the Everglades as a cesspit. Of course, it was imperative that the corrupt arrangement between Chaz and Red remain secret, and in that regard, Chaz's serial philandering proved to be a continuing source of concern. More than once, Red Hammernut reminded Chaz that his fortunes would take a radically negative turn if he told any of his girlfriends the name of his true employer. Ironically, the woman about whom Red Hammernut worried least was Chaz's wife, because it seemed that Chaz didn't tell her much of anything. Then came the phone call, Chaz jabbering frantically that Joey had caught him forging the water data. Red asking over and over, "You sure she knows what it is?" Chaz saying that he couldn't be certain because Joey had just dropped the subject afterward. Over the phone, though, he had sounded suspicious, definitely spooked. Red Hammernut urged him to stay cool. "Don't assume nothing. Wait and see what she says about it." And Joey Perrone hadn't said anything, not a word. Still, Chaz had remained anxious, and it rubbed off on Red. What if Wifey had figured out the Everglades deal and decided to keep quiet and bide her time? In Red's worst nightmare, Joey would catch Chaz with his weenie in the wrong bun and become so enraged that she'd blab to the Water District about his phony samples. Trying to buy her silence would be useless because she didn't need the dough. According to Chaz, Joey was worth millions. As the days turned into weeks, Chaz seemed to calm down. He hadn't talked so much about his wife or what she might suspect, so Red Hammernut had assumed that the situation on the home front had ironed itself out. Suddenly, Joey Perrone was dead, and now somebody was trying to blackmail Chaz. Or so he said. Red Hammernut couldn't rule out the possibility that the young man might be trying to rip him off. It would not be entirely out of character. "You sure it's the detective?" Red asked. "Who the hell else could it be? He's the only one who's been hassling me about Joey." Chaz was waving his hands in agitation. He tried to disguise his voice over the phone and make like he was Charlton Heston. Toole grunted quizzically. "That NRA guy," Red explained. "The one's got old-timer's disease."
"He's also in the movies," Chaz said thinly.
"You know who does a funny personation of Heston? That Robin Williams fella. Red, are you even listening to me?" "Course I am, son. This detective who does voices of movie stars, you think he's the same guy that's been sneaking into your house?"
"Absolutely. It'd be damned easy for a cop," Chaz declared.
"Know what he did today? Turned on my sprinklers. Pouring rain when I get home. And the sprinklers are running like Niagara fucking Falls. Dumb shit like that. It can make you nuts."
Red Hammernut thinking, "He must be reading my mind." They were squeezed together like nuns in the back of the gray Cadillac. Red stinking like a knockoff Monte Cristo, Toole like a wet bull, and Chaz Perrone like the county dump where he had just tossed several boxes of his wife's belongings. Red Hammernut had sent his driver into the donut shop in case Chaz blurted out something stupid or incriminating. It was a conversation that had to be managed carefully, as Red didn't wish to be taxed with unnecessary details. Whatever had happened between Chaz and Joey Perrone aboard the cruise ship was a private matter and ought to stay that way. Eyeing Chaz now, Red had trouble picturing him tossing anybody overboard, especially Joey, who was a big, strong girl. Toole could have handled her, no problem. But Chaz?
"Maybe he's tougher than he looks," Red thought.
He said, "Son, you want to hear something wild? I met him this morning. Your cop."
"Rolvog?"
Chaz turned ashen.
"Christ! How? Drove all the way up to the farm to ask me about a rented minivan."
Red shot a sideways glance at Toole, who was absently picking a scab on his neck.
"Did he mention my name?"
Chaz asked anxiously.
"He did not. Gave me a bullshit story, which I believed at the time, about Toole's good looks scaring some friends of the sheriff. Needless to say, I didn't know it was the same detective that's been riding your ass."
Toole spoke up.
"Red, I was ready to take care of him. Your boy here told me not to."
"He was right," Red Hammernut said. "You can't deal with cops the same way you deal with beaners. That's a damn fact."
Chaz sighed dispiritedly. Toole cracked his knuckles and said,
"I don't get how anybody can do a blackmail if your boy here ain't committed no crime."
Red laughed to himself. Once again, the man had gotten straight to the nut of the matter. The guy on the phone says he saw me throw Joey over the side of the ship. That's just not true, Chaz said. Tool crinkled his brow.
What's not true? You didn't do it, or you did do it and nobody saw?
Chaz opened his mouth to respond, but a sickly quack came out. Red Hammernut quickly changed the subject.
This Rovog, he didn't strike me as a type to be running his own game. I've been around long enough to know a crook when I see him.
And I'm telling you, he's the only one it could be. Chaz didn't sound as certain as Red would have liked. If Chaz had, in fact, thrown his wife off the ship, some stranger could have witnessed it. Another passenger, a cabin boy, whoever.
This blackmailer fella, let's make sure who he is and how much he wants, Red said to Chaz. Could be just some smart-ass just saw the story on the news and got the bright idea to shake you down. That kind of shit we can handle.
He nodded confidently toward Tool.
But if it's really the cop, like you say, then we gotta be extra careful. He can cause all sort of problem, even if you ain't done nothing wrong.
Through clenched teeth, Chaz said, I haven't, Red. Like I said, it was an accident.
Take it easy, son. I believe you.
Tool, who was probing a hangnail with a rusty fishhook, snorted doubtfully.
Next time this sumbitch calls, Red Hammernut said, you try and set up a meeting. Christ, Red, you mean face to face?
Chaz whined.
But why? What are we going to do?
Listen politely to whatever he's got to say, Red said.
And son, let's be clear on this. It ain't we. It's you.
13. Mick Stranahan phoned Charles Perrone at 5:42 a.m.
Good morning, dipshit,
he said, this time doing Jerry Lewis. The Mexican writer who owned the island adored the Nutty Professor, and Stranahan had watched it often on the VCR. There were worse ways to get through a tropical depression. At the other end of the line, Joey Perrone's husband needed a few moments to rouse himself.
Are you the same guy who called yesterday?
That's right,
Chaz Perrone said.
We should get together, you and me.
Why?
To talk.
We're talking now,
Stranahan said.
You tossed your beloved into the Atlantic Ocean. I'm curious to hear an explanation.
I didn't push her. She fell.
That's not what I saw.
Listen to me, Perrone pleaded, but his voice trailed away.
Yoo-hoo! Chaz!
We should do this in person.
Do what? There's $1,800 in your checking account,
Stranahan said.
That's pitiful.
I can get more, Perrone blurted, then warily, how do you know what I have in the bank?
Pitiful!
Don't hang up, don't!
Stranahan said,
how would you ever get enough money?
People owe me. Stranahan laughed.
Are you a biologist or a loan shark?
Okay, Rolvog, tell me how much you want.
Again with the Rolvog stuff, thought Stranahan.
I haven't decided on an amount, he said.
Okay, when can we get together? I'm serious.
Bye-bye, Chaz!
Wait, Perrone said. I've got to ask. That voice you're doing?
Yeah?
Jim Carrey, right?
Stranahan said.
Mister, my price just doubled.
Tool filled the bedroom doorway, demanding to know who the hell was calling so early in the morning. When Chaz Perrone said it was the blackmailer, Tool swore groggily and lurched back to bed. It had been a long, fitful night, the fentanyl patches having dried up one by one, dying like flowers. The so-called doctor had been no help whatsoever. Obviously, he hated the idea of Tool staying inside his house, and the feeling was mutual.
But Red was the boss man, and Red said he didn't want Tool out on the street freaking the neighbors. He was to remain with the doctor and make sure nobody else broke in. Chaz Perrone grudgingly had surrendered the guest bedroom. Later, Tool had attempted a shower, but within 5 minutes he shed so much tarry body hair that the drain clogged. Chaz had cleaned it up with a coat hanger, not saying a word, but Tool could tell he was ticked. For breakfast, Tool had prepared an omelet, using 9 eggs, a pint of clotted cream, a half pound of cheddar, assorted peppers, a paw full of pitted olives, and 4 ounces of Tabasco. As Tool slurped down the pungent creation, the doctor reeled from the kitchen in disgust. Afterward, Tool announced he was heading out in search of medicine.
"Where's the closest hospital?" he asked Chaz Perrone.
"Are you out of your mind? You can't sneak into a hospital and steal that stuff."
"Wherever there's a hospital, there's a nursing home close by. Or else, what you call it? A place where they put, you know, the terminals. Them that's gonna die."
"You mean like a hospice?"
"Right," Tool said. "Where the people are too sickly to make a fuss. And then, I look around till I find the ones with stick-on patches."
"Jesus." The doctor suddenly got quiet.
"Well?" Tool demanded.
"Does Mr. Hammernut know you do this?"
"Red don't pry himself into my business."
"Smart man." Charles Perrone reached for a pen. "The nearest hospital is Cypress Creek. I'll write down the directions."
"Draw me a picture instead."
"A map, you mean?" Tool smiled.
"Yeah, that'd be good."
He had dumped the minivan at Hertz and defected to Avis for a black Grand Marquis. The extra legroom was a treat, and the air conditioning was purely glorious. Once Tool located the hospital, he began scouting adjacent neighborhoods for likely targets. The first place was called Serenity Villas, but he backed off as soon as he realized it was an assisted living facility. That meant that the old folks were still hoofing around pretty good. And in Tool's experience, they did not part easily with their medications. His next stop was Elysian Manor, a convalescent home run by a local church. Tool put on the size XXXL lab whites that he always carried and entered through a rear service door. For a large man, he moved unobtrusively, checking one bed at a time. Some of the patients, as frail as baby sparrows, were sound asleep. Those Tool gently rolled over to inspect for patches. The patients who were awake behaved cooperatively, although one launched into a fractured monologue that Tool couldn't sort out. Something about a sellout in Yalta. Wherever the hell that was. The lack of visitors was one reason that Tool favored nursing homes over hospitals. Why people spent so little time with their ailing mothers and fathers, he didn't know, but it was a bankable fact. In only one room at Elysian Manor did Tool encounter a relative perched at a patient's bedside, Tool excusing himself with a wave and moving on down the hall. Nobody in authority displayed the slightest interest in his presence. The harried nurses assumed he was a newly hired orderly, turnover being universally rampant at geriatric facilities. He hit pay dirt in number 33, a private room. The patient, a bony-shouldered woman with permed silver hair, was curled up, sleeping with her face to the wall. The back of her cotton gown was untied, revealing on her papery gray skin a crisp new patch of fentanyl. Tool crept forward and began to peel it off. The woman spun violently, her knobby right elbow nailing him like a cudgel between the eyes. Rocking backward, Tool groped for the bed rail to steady himself.
"What are you up to?"
The woman's fierce blue eyes were clear and alert.
"Changing out your patch," Tool mumbled.
"But they just gave me a new one an hour ago."
"Ma'am, I just do what they tell me."
"I believe that's a load of bullcrap," she said.
"This is no good," Tool thought. "She's too damn ornery." "They'll bring you more,"
he said. Come on now, roll over.
You're sick, too, I can tell. Is it cancer?
Toole fingered the rising lump on his forehead.
I ain't sick, he said, glancing at the door.
He expected somebody to barge in any second.
I'm Maureen, the woman pointed at a straight-backed chair in the corner. Pull that over here and sit. What's your name?
Toole said.
Nice and easy now. Let me take off that patch, then you can go back to sleep.
Maureen sat herself up, plumping a pillow behind her head.
I must look terrible, she said, touching her hair.
I wasn't sleeping, for your information. In my condition, who could sleep?
Pull up that chair. I'll give you what you want.
All Toole could think about was the warm embrace of the drug, deep and delicious. He dragged the chair over to Maureen's bedside and sat down.
You're in pain, aren't you? She inquired.
Damn straight. I got a bullet up the crack of my ass.
Yow.
That's how come I need the dope, Toole said. So, what do you say?
He didn't want to take it by force. She was a scrapper and he'd have to get rough, maybe even strangle her.
How did you happen to be shot? She asked.
Hunting accident.
And they couldn't remove it surgically?
Guess not, Toole said.
My late husband was a police officer in the city of Chicago, Illinois. He shot a man once.
Not up the ass, I bet.
It was in the shoulder, Maureen said. The fellow was a hardened criminal. He robbed a gypsy cab. Are you a criminal?
Not to my way of thinking.
Toole was perspiring through his medical whites. He fought the urge to tear the patch from the old coot's hide and bolt for the door. Maureen said,
All right. I can see you need the medicine more than I do.
She turned and presented her bare back, gesturing over one shoulder.
Go ahead and take it, but please be careful. I tend to bleed for no darn reason these days.
Toole started at a top corner of the patch and peeled carefully downward, as if removing a decal.
They'll bring you more,
he assured Maureen.
Tell him to come off while you was in the bath.
I don't have a tub, young man. They bathe me with a sponge.
In bed? Don't that make a mess?
Maureen said,
I miss my privacy. I really do.
After Toole was done, she rolled over to look at him again.
I'm 81 years old, but I feel like 110. Please tell me your name.
Earl.
Toole scarcely recognized his own voice. Nobody left on Earth called him Earl.
Is your mother still alive? Maureen asked.
Nope. Not my daddy neither.
I'm sorry, Earl. I hope it wasn't cancer.
That's what you got?
Maureen nodded.
But some days I feel pretty chipper. Some days I surprise myself.
Toole stared down at the flesh-colored patch in his hand, thinking,
Why couldn't she have been asleep? Or at least a veggie?
No. You keep that, Maureen said, patting him on the arm. I want you to feel better.
Appreciate it.
He was three steps toward the door when he heard, Earl, could you pop in and visit me again sometime? Toole stopped and turned.
Ma'am, I don't really work here.
Oh, I know.
Her blue eyes were dancing.
What do I look like? Some sort of nitwit?
Rolvag was working on his resignation package when Captain Gallo came over and said,
Tomorrow's the last day you waste on Perone.
Yes, I remember, Rolvag said. Reason I mention it, I got a call from the man. No kidding. Gallo always referred to the sheriff as the man.
He asked what you were doing up in LaBelle yesterday, and I didn't have a real swift comeback, Gallo said, seeing as how I've been in Florida 30 fucking years and never had a reason to go there.
Rolvag explained that he'd been tracking a lead in the cruise ship case.
And that took you to the office of Mr. Samuel Johnson Hammonut, Gallo said. I hope you know who he is.
A farmer, the detective said.
No.
A millionaire CEO farmer with heavyweight clout. Soon as you leave, Hammernut calls his asshole buddy, the sheriff of Henry County, who right away calls the sheriff of Broward County, that would be my boss and yours, and wants to know who the hell's this Carl Rolvag. Next thing I know, I get a call asking how come you're hassling a fine, upstanding citizen like Red Hammernut.
Gallo spread his arms as if awaiting crucifixion.
And what is my response, Carl? Besides stuttering like some sort of mental defective, what can I possibly say to the man?
Rolvag capped his pen and sat back.
It's interesting that Hammernut would react that way, don't you think?
Are you dicking with me, Carl?
No, sir. I'm only trying to finish my resignation papers.
Gallo said, Aw, knock it off.
I'm serious about the job in Minnesota.
Yeah, whatever, the captain said. Just tell me how a rich cracker like Hammernut could possibly fit into your case.
And I use the word loosely. Rolvag informed Gallo about the man staking out Perrone's house. He used one of Hammernut's credit cards to rent the minivan.
And that's all?
So far. But it's strange, you've got to admit. Why would anyone be tailing a recently widowed man?
Carl, we can't go to a grand jury with strange. The whole damn human race is strange, Gallo said. You and your choice of roommates, for example. Some people would say that's slightly shy of normal.
Rolvag said, Lots of folks keep pet snakes.
I'll explain to the man it was just a dry hole, your road trip to LaBelle.
Okay, if it'll make your life easier.
What about you? And don't give me any more horseshit about moving back north, Gallo said. Just tell me what you want, Carl. A raise? Weekends off? I can't promise anything, but sometimes miracles do happen.
The detective said, I think Mr. Perrone pushed his wife off that ship. I probably can't prove it in the short time before I leave here, but that's what I believe. Could you give me a couple more days to work the case?
What bothered Rolvag the most were the broken fingernails that he'd found in that bale of grass. He couldn't stop thinking of Joey Perrone, desperate and terrified, trying to hang on in the waves, all the while pondering the dreadful thing that her husband had done, hanging on in the chill and the darkness until finally her arms went numb and she slipped into the sea.
No way, Gallo was saying. Sorry, Carl. I'm pulling the plug.
Suppose I came up with the motive.
In the next, what, 24 hours?
You betcha.
Then I'd have to reconsider.
Sure I would, Gallo said.
But it better be fucking brilliant.
Maybe I'll get lucky.
Rolvag sounded far more confident than he felt, having no theory, no hunch, not even a wild guess as to why Chaz Perrone had so casually murdered his wife. The generator broke down before Stranahan could start breakfast. He was still working on it when Joey Perrone awoke and came outside.
The joys of island living, she said.
Old Neil was right. Rust never sleeps.
Stranahan was wearing cut-off jeans and no shirt, dripping sweat, grease smeared like war paint on his face and chest. Joey asked if he wanted some help, and he said what he really needed was dynamite.
That bad, huh?
I'll fix it eventually, he said, twirling a mallet. In the meantime, there are some delectable bran flakes in the cupboard.
Joey asked to borrow his cellular.
He pointed to the boat, where the phone was recharging on the battery plug, and went back to banging on the generator. 20 minutes later, Joey returned with a pitcher of tea and a bowl of fruit from the kitchen. They walked down to the dock and sat down, Joey tickling the water with her toes. Strom blinked at them from the shade of his favorite palm.
I'm getting worried about using my credit card, Joey said.
Stranahan assured her that American Express didn't know that she was missing, and didn't care as long as the payments got made. They don't read the newspapers. Unless somebody calls up and cancels the card, it stays active, he explained. The balance is automatically deducted from a private money market account, but the monthly statement is mailed to the house. What if Chaz gets nosy?
Another reason we should work fast, said Stranahan, before the billing cycle ends. He'll probably just toss the statement into the trash, but if he opens it, then we've got a problem. He'll see that you're continuing to spend money.
Yeah, neat trick for a corpse.
Joey turned her face upward and squeezed her eyes closed.
The sun still hurts.
It hasn't even been a week. Next time we go to the mainland, we'll find you some cool shades.
She said, I dreamed about Chaz again last night.
Killing him?
Worse. Joey rolled her eyes.
Can you believe it, Mick? Even after what he's done, I'm still having sex with the guy in my sleep?
It's emotional withdrawal, that's all. Like when you try to kick caffeine, suddenly the whole damn world smells like Folgers.
Joey worked her lower lip.
Maybe I actually loved that creep up until the end. Maybe it was more than physical, and I can't admit it.
Stranahan shrugged. Don't look at me. I'm the crown prince of dysfunctional. What's important is figuring out how you feel about him here and now, before we make another move. The dog ambled over and stretched out on the warm planks beside Joey. That was my brother I called earlier, she said. The people who take care of my money contacted him because someone saw in the paper that I was lost at sea. Corbett told them to sit tight. They can't do anything without a death certificate anyway.
Chaz hadn't called to snoop around about the trust?
Nope. My brother was surprised, too. Joey smiled ruefully. In a weird way, I wish Chaz had done it for my money.
Then I could almost understand, she said. But killing somebody just to be rid of them, man, it's hard not to take it personally.
That's not why he did this, Joey. You'll see. Stranahan put an arm around her, and she let her head drop lightly against his shoulder. What does Corbett think you should do?
He likes the idea of me driving Chaz clinically insane, she said. Float around like a ghost, he says, until the bastard loses his marbles.
It could happen.
Oh, guess what else? Joey lifted her head. This detective keeps calling Corbett to talk about Chaz. The same guy Corbett spoke with on Monday. And now he's calling back, leaving messages.
Stranahan said, So the heat's on. Just like you want it.
It would be fun to think so.
And one more reason to be careful, thought Stranahan. The trick would be putting the cop into play without exposing themselves. Did your brother tell you the detective's name? He asked.
Rolvag. Carl Rolvag. She said, with a K, not a C.
I'll be damned. I even wrote down the phone number, she added, in lipstick, unfortunately on the deck of your boat.
No problem, Stranahan said cheerfully.
What's so funny?
Chaz.
He thinks the cop is the blackmailer. On the phone this morning, he even called me Rolvag.
Joey was delighted. Then, hey, wait a minute, you talked to Chaz and you didn't even tell me?
You were sleeping, Stranahan said.
So what?
In a languid state of undress. Frankly, I was intimidated.
Mick. That's a compliment, by the way. Was I snoring?
Moaning, actually. If I'd known you were dreaming about Chaz, I would have thrown you under a cold shower. Joey took a playful swing, and he caught her fist with the palm of his hand. Go wash up. I got you all grimy.
She said, Buddy, if you're not careful.
Giving Stranahan a look that reminded him of Andrea Krumholtz, his very first girlfriend, on the night she'd slipped off her bra and tossed it out a window of Stranahan's father's car. For Mick, 16 at the time, it had been a sublimely instructive moment. To Joey, he said, Guess I'd better get back to work.
You sure about that?
There's 5 pounds of lobster in the freezer. It would be a mortal sin to let it spoil. She said,
Okay,
go fix your stupid generator. Stranahan finished the job 2 hours later, arms aching, knuckles raw.
He went looking for Joey to give her the news, but she wasn't reading in bed or sunning on the seawall or roughhousing on the dock with the dog. In fact, she wasn't anywhere on the island. Strom wagged his nub, but offered up no information. The whaler was still tied up to the pilings, so Stranahan wasn't completely shocked to throw open the doors of the shed and find the yellow kayak missing. By then, Joey was so far gone that the hunting scope was useless in spotting her. He climbed the roof to better scan the water, but all the bright specks turned into sailboats and windsurfers and water bikes. He thought about taking the skiff and hunting her down, but he also thought about how bone-tired and grungy he was and how good a cold beer would taste. As soon as he hopped off the roof, the Doberman started yipping and whining reproachfully, nipping at his heels all the way to the kitchen. "Oh, shut up," Stranahan said. "She'll be back." 14. Nick Stranahan's sister was married to a lawyer named Kipper Garth, inept in all aspects of the profession except self-promotion. He had been one of the first personal injury hustlers in Florida to advertise on television and billboards, attracting a stampede of impressionable clients whose cases he dealt out like pinochle cards to legitimate attorneys in exchange for a slice of the take. As even his rivals conceded, Kipper Garth helped to pioneer the preposterous notion that finding a good lawyer was as easy as dialing up a plumber in the Yellow Pages. It pained Stranahan that his sister Katie had fallen for such a shyster, and that she'd stayed with him despite serial philandering, scalding IRS audits, and a ruinous gambling addiction. A cranial injury inflicted by a jealous husband had forced Kipper Garth into an early retirement, and in short order he'd burned up the family savings wagering on British cricket, a sport he never bothered to understand. In the face of bankruptcy, he had reopened his practice, inspired by advanced pain medication and a fresh marketing angle. A new series of TV commercials featured him tooling around a law library in the same wheelchair to which he had been confined during his homebound rehabilitation. The aim was to present himself as both lawyer and victim, qualified by empathy, if not expertise, to specialize in disability litigation. Always a trend hound, Kipper Garth had come across a newspaper article about a pair of lawyers who drove around South Florida scouting restaurants, shops, and office buildings for wheelchair accessibility. If a place didn't have the required ramps or lifts, the lawyers would recruit a disabled person, often a friend or relative, to sue. Typically, the case would settle before trial, the owners of the building eager to avoid headlines implying they were callous toward the handicapped. The scheme was perfectly suited to Kipper Garth's singular talent, and soon he was back in tall cotton, overseeing half a dozen runners who scoured the Tri-County area for wheelchair ramp violations. Throughout good times and bad, Mick Stranahan contrived to avoid his sister's husband, and timed his visits to Kate's house on days when Kipper Garth was gone. Kate was always happy to see Mick, though she maintained a long-standing ban against discussing Kipper's multiple character flaws. Theirs was one of those marriages that Stranahan couldn't hope to understand, but he had come to accept it as unbreakable. He saw no reason to inform Kate that he now required her husband's slithering assistance.
"Sorry, Mick," Kipper Garth told him. "No can do."
Stranahan was skeptically inspecting the wheelchair slanted in a corner of his brother-in-law's spacious bayfront office.
"I still need it on occasion," Kipper Garth said preemptively. "I get spells."
A putter was propped against one of the wheelchair's tires. Three shiny new golf balls were lined up on the carpet. Stranahan sat down in front of the desk.
"Does the Bar Association know you can walk? Or is there no rule against impersonating a cripple on TV?"
Kipper Garth bristled.
"It's what they call a dramatic recreation."
"Try misrepresentation," said Stranahan, "with the stink of fraud."
"How about it, Jocko? Are you going to help me or do I make the phone call?"
"Katie would never forgive you."
"She did the last time."
Kipper Garth's neck turned crimson.
Many years earlier, Stranahan had voluntarily testified against him in a grievance hearing that had unfolded poorly for the lawyer. Disbarment had seemed inevitable until a cuckolded husband had beamed Kipper Garth with a highlight ball, knocking him out of action and thereby sparing the Florida bar a mountain of paperwork.
"Mick, this really isn't up my alley."
Kipper Garth, smoothing his necktie and brushing invisible lint from his lapels.
"Here." He reached for his Filofax. "Let me give you some names."
Stranahan leaned over and grabbed his wrist. "It's boilerplate, Jocko. A first-year law student could do this blindfolded." Kipper Garth pulled his arm away, though not too assertively. He knew enough of his brother-in-law's volcanic history to avoid physical confrontation. He also knew that the wheelchair caper was but one of many transgressions that Mick had learned about and strategically kept to himself. Stranahan unfolded a yellow piece of lined paper and pushed it across the desk, saying, "That's everything you'll need." The information seemed innocuous and straightforward. Kipper Garth was sure that his secretary could format a suitable document with the office software.
"All right, Mick. I'll do this for you," he said, motioning toward the double doors. "Go ahead and bring her in."
"Who?" Stranahan said.
"A client."
"Oh, she's not here."
Kipper Garth looked puzzled.
"Why not?"
"Because she's missing." "Excuse me?"
"Well, she is and she isn't," Stranahan said.
"You mean like Amelia Earhart type missing, or escaped prisoner type missing?"
Kipper Garth was clutching to the hope that his brother-in-law was joking.
"It's complicated," said Stranahan. "But I'll need a signature, obviously.
Tell you what, just leave that part blank." Kipper Garth felt his gut tighten.
"The signature is supposed to be witnessed."
"I was counting on the blind loyalty of your secretarial staff. Hey, I almost forgot. Date it in early March, would you?"
"For next year."
Stranahan said, "No, this year. Date it 4 weeks ago." His brother-in-law's voice deflated to a plaintive rasp.
"Meh. Come on. I could get prosecuted for this."
"Oh, they wouldn't do that to a man in a wheelchair."
"I'm serious. The shit hits the fan, I'll deny everything."
"I would expect no less," Stranahan said. Kipper Garth held up the yellow paper and shook it.
"What the hell's this all about? What have you got yourself into?"
Mick Stranahan glanced impatiently at his wristwatch. "We're wasting precious time, Jocko," he said. "Chop, chop." For the second day in a row, Charles Perrone called in sick to the water district. Rika came over and brought him lunch, a ham sandwich, nacho chips, and a lobster salad. What the neighbors might think of his voluptuous female visitor was no longer high on Chaz's list of concerns. He had more urgent problems.
"What's the matter?" Rika asked.
"You name it."
"Wanna talk?"
"Nope." He led her to the bedroom and undressed her. 25 minutes later, she rolled wearily off the mattress and refastened her bra.
"I'm sorry, baby. I gotta get back to work."
Chaz Perrone flicked at himself, as slack as a noodle, under the sheets.
"I can't fucking believe this." "Hey, it happens to all guys, like I said before."
Rika was in the bathroom, trying to sound as if she wasn't disappointed. She emerged, brushing her hair with military briskness.
"You tell me if there was someone else, wouldn't you, Chaz?"
"Jesus.
I don't want to be the last to know,"
he said. "Keep talking, and I'll be shopping the internet for an implant." She picked up her handbag and kissed him on the nose.
"You'll be okay, baby. You're just having a tough time moving on, that's all."
"Don't start, I'm begging you."
"After the memorial, you'll be good as new," Rika said. "Once you say goodbye to Joey, it's back to your old studly self."
Chaz scowled. "I already said goodbye."
I don't think you have. I think that's the problem.
Minutes after Rika departed, Chaz heard Tool come in the front door. He poked his anvil-sized head in the bedroom and asked with dull indifference if everything was cool.
Yeah. Peachy.
Who is the girl? I seen her car here before.
Grief counselor, Chaz said. Tool eyed the doctor's trousers and boxer shorts, which were crumpled in a heap by the bed. He said,
When my mama passed, they sent a Pentecostal preacher by the house.
Everybody's got their own way of coping. Did you find your stickums?
Just one so far, but it's brand new.
Tool pivoted to exhibit the shaved spot where he'd slapped the fentanyl patch on his shoulder blade.
Maybe I'll go crash for a spell, he said.
Charles Perrone waved. Sweet dreams. He waited until Tool disappeared into the guest room, then reached into the nightstand and took out his new gun. Overwhelmed by the selection at Walmart, he'd gone to a pawn shop in Margate, where an imaginatively tattooed neo-Nazi had sold him a basic Colt 38. Sitting in bed now, Chaz hefted the blue-plated pistol from one hand to the other and wondered about its murky provenance. For all he knew, it could have been used in some vicious robbery, or even to kill a person. There was a box of hollow-point bullets in the drawer, but Chaz was hesitant to load the weapon. He'd once heard on CNN that homeowners who buy guns for protection are about 50 times more likely to shoot themselves or be shot than they are to cap an intruder. Since he'd never fired anything more powerful than a BB rifle, Chaz inserted the bullets with the utmost care. After returning the .38 to the drawer, he sank into a melancholy rumination. What if flaky Rika was right? He'd purged every remnant of his dead wife from the house, and still his pecker remained obstinately on strike. Although he'd never confess it to Rika, the only time Chaz experienced the slightest twitch of spontaneous lust was when he thought about Joey. That morning in the shower, for example, he'd been going over the crime moment by moment in his head. Why, he didn't know. Remembering the tang of the ocean, the drizzling rain on his face, the amber lights lining the rails of the deck, the low, heavy drone of the ship's engines, and Joey's ankles. That's what had done it for him, remembering how silky and warm her ankles had felt when he'd grabbed them. God, what outstanding legs! Feeling a blissfully familiar pulsation, Chaz had peeked down to greet his little perpendicular accomplice. Avidly he had hunched over on himself, kneading and tugging to no avail, until finally the hot water ran out, and all was lost. So it's possible that Rika is right, he thought. Maybe his subconscious hadn't yet let go of Joey, although it was only the sexual part of the marriage that he missed. Otherwise, I'm as steady as an ox, Chaz assured himself. I did what had to be done. Sooner or later, his wife would have caught him screwing around and, out of spite, ratted on him for faking the Everglades data. She would have ruined everything, his credentials as a biologist, his secret pact with Red, his whole golden future. Because she knew the truth. Of course she did. Hadn't she seen it with her own eyeballs, him forging the water charts? I only did what was necessary, Chaz thought. And I could do it again. On impulse, he snatched the phone and dialed a golfing buddy, a well-known wild man on the weekend club scene. You know those pills you tried to feed me at the Richardson's bachelor party? I've got a friend who wants to try the stuff.
A friend? Sure, Chaz.
Jesus! They're not for me! My wife just died, in case you hadn't heard. What kind of a heartless prick do you think I am?
Sorry, man, I'm really sorry. How many does he want, your friend?
I don't know. What's in a starter kit? Chaz asked. Half a dozen?
No problemo.
And you said they're stronger than what doctors give out.
Oh, yeah. The FDA definitely would not approve.
Where are you at now? Have you got them on you?
I'm hitting a bucket of balls at Boca Pines North. Your friend's in a hurry, huh?
Yeah, I think he's got a hot date. Meet me at the clubhouse in, like, an hour.
Perfect, Chaz said. I owe you one.
Hey, don't worry about it.
Then after a discomfited pause, man, it's really terrible what happened to Joey. That's gotta be so fucking rough. How you hanging in?
Oh, some days are better than others, said Chaz Perone.
After leaving Kipper Garth's law office, Mick Stranahan went back to Dinner Key to see if Joey had returned to the marina. There was no sign of his kayak or the rented Suburban. Stranahan didn't feel like driving up to Boca, but he couldn't wait in Coconut Grove all afternoon. These days he had no patience for anything but fishing. From his billfold he retrieved a scrap of paper on which he had written the tag number of the blue Ford belonging to Chaz Perone's mistress of the moment. Only two investigators at the state attorney's office remembered Stranahan favorably enough to help, and he phoned one of them as he headed north on the interstate. By the time he passed the county line, Stranahan had a name, age, address, marital status, and occupation. Rika Jane Spillman held a cosmetology license from the state of Florida, so it was simply a matter of figuring out where she worked. Stranahan made a pit stop in Hallandale to find a payphone, ripping a sheaf of beauty salon listings from the yellow pages. He narrowed his search to the western suburbs of northern Broward, and after only 55 minutes of blind calling, he located Chaz's girlfriend. She was a senior stylist slash colorist at a shop called Hair Jordan, and by chance she happened to have an opening at 5:30 p.m. Like many of Boca's finest establishments, the salon was shoehorned into a coral-colored strip mall. Mick Stranahan parked the rust-eaten Cordoba in the rear, where it was less likely to draw stares. He drew a few himself as he walked through the door of Hair Jordan in his grease-stained shirt, faded khakis, and scuffed topsiders. Taking cover behind a magazine, Stranahan attempted to immerse himself in the travails of Eminem, a deep, though conflicted young man. Apparently wealth, fame, and unlimited sex are nice, but true spiritual happiness must come from within.
Mr. Smith? Hi.
It was Rika, motioning for Stranahan to follow her.
You can bring the magazine if you like.
He was somewhat embarrassed by his hair, which was tacky with salt and piled oddly to one side, a result of the windy boat ride across Biscayne Bay. Rika said nothing about it, but during the shampoo she commented admiringly on his deep tan. Stranahan said that his job kept him out in the sun.
Yeah? Where do you work?
She asked, lightly toweling his head.
On a cruise ship.
Oh.
Stranahan watched her expression closely in the mirror. You ever been on one?
A cruise?
No, Rika said, less bubbly than before.
The ships are like a city, they're so big.
She removed a pair of shears from the sterilizer.
How short do you like it? Tops of the ears?
I was thinking of a buzz cut, like Clint Eastwood had in that Grenada movie.
Okay.
Just kidding, Stranahan said.
He let her work in silence for a few minutes, Rika obviously distracted, before he started up again.
Do you get seasick? Lots of people do.
Sometimes, she said.
What exactly do you do on the ship?
Your job, I mean.
Security.
Oh. Wow.
Stranahan bowed his head to accommodate the arc of her trimming.
As I said, it's like a city. Good citizens, bad citizens.
But it's mostly drunks, right? They don't have, like, serious crimes out there.
You'd be surprised, he said. Just the other night, some guy pushed his wife overboard.
The snip, snip, snip of the shears ceased. Rika's eyes locked on Stranahan's in the mirror.
That's not funny, Mr. Smith.
Oh, I'm dead serious, he said.
Took her by the legs and flipped her over the rail.
Oh, my God.
Stranahan put on an apologetic smile.
Here I am, trying to talk you into a tropical cruise, and I end up scaring you with some awful story. I'm sorry. I really am.
No, it's my fault for asking.
Rika's hands were trembling so badly now that she slapped the scissors down on a tray, picked up a comb, and started dragging it mechanically through his half-cut hair. Stranahan felt sorry for her. He felt sorry for any woman who'd bought into Charles Perrone's bullshit.
In a small voice, she asked, "What did they do to the guy?"
"He got away, believe it or not."
But how?
At least he thought he did. Stranahan winked. The son of a bitch didn't know that someone saw the whole thing. Me. By now, Rika was in no condition to handle sharp instruments, so Stranahan removed the shiny barber sheet from around his neck. Stepping back from the chair, Rika said,
"Who are you?"
Keeping her voice low so that Mr. Jordan, the owner, wouldn't know that something was wrong. Stranahan took out a 20 and placed it on the tray beside the scissors. "Chaz didn't tell you how it went down?" She shook her head stiffly.
"He said it was an accident."
"Oh, no. It was murder. Premeditated."
"Why didn't you, like, stop him?"
"Happened too fast. One second she's standing there, the next she's shark chum. Just like that." Stranahan snapped his fingers sharply. Rika jumped.
"No way. Chaz said he was sleeping when it happened."
"He's lying to you, Rika," Stranahan said. "He's an extremely bad person. A cold-hearted killer, if you want the truth. My advice is to find yourself a new boyfriend."
"Who the hell are you?"
"Chazzy's future business partner. Tell him I dropped by."
"How'd you find me? You'd better go right now."
"Sure," Stranahan said. "But you should know that Dr. Perrone's life is about to get infinitely more complicated. Keep the car running."
"Get out,"
she whispered. Stranahan ate dinner at a Thai joint at the other end of the mall. Rika's blue Ford was gone when he passed the salon on the way out. Either she was on her way to confront Chaz or was hurrying home to bolt the door, fix herself a drink, and contemplate the disquieting fact that she was dating a murderer. The short drive to West Boca Dunes Phase 2 took nearly 30 minutes in rush-hour traffic. Stranahan was homicidal by the time he turned down Chaz Perrone's street. But he grinned at the sight of the rented Suburban, his yellow kayak strapped to the racks, parked in the driveway of the fugitive telemarketers. He pulled in next to the green barge, rolled down the window, and waited for Joey to do the same. Nothing happened. Peering through the tinted glass, Stranahan realized with a pitching heart that the Suburban was empty. "Hell," he said, and turned his gaze on the Perrone residence. Joey had snuck inside again, which was problematic, since her husband's yellow Hummer was parked out front. So was a dark sedan, either a Grand Marquis or a Crown Vic. Stranahan was out of his car and moving quickly when a third vehicle rolled up behind the Humvee. It was a white Toyota, or possibly an Audi. Stranahan couldn't be certain in the twilight. He shoved his hands in his pockets and slowed to a casual stroll, watching as a woman with frizzy red hair and wind chime earrings got out of the car. As Stranahan neared the house, the front door swung open, and there was Charles Perrone, holding what looked like a bottle of wine. With the other hand, he beckoned the red-haired woman inside. "So, it's a party," thought Mick Stranahan. "How nice." 15. Joey Perrone had planned nothing more sinister than a shopping trip. At dinner key, she hauled the kayak out of the water and tied it on top of the Suburban. Then she drove to Merrick Park, where she purchased a shoulder bag, a bikini, four pairs of Italian shoes, a canvas ball cap, and hilarious Versace sunglasses. She was feeling almost human by the time she stopped at the Andalusia Bakery in search of a key lime tart. Then, out of nowhere, it hit her again. The fact that her husband had very nearly murdered her. If she hadn't known how to dive, she wouldn't be alive to enjoy the sunshine on her bare arms, Nora Jones on the radio, the scent of new purse leather.
It had been Chaz's wish for her to end up in the steaming belly of a shark, or nibbled to pieces by crabs and needlefish. That asshole, thought Joey, and headed straight for the interstate. 50 minutes later, she was removing the spare key from the bird feeder in her backyard. She entered the house through the rear door and turned off the alarm. A heavy chill took hold of her as she prowled through the familiar rooms. There was no trace of her anywhere. From past incursions, Joey was aware that Chaz had removed the obvious reminders, photographs, clothes, CDs. Now, though, even more was missing. Paintings and pencil sketches that she had picked out were gone from the walls. A crystal figurine of a dolphin that she'd given him for Valentine's Day had been taken from the bookcase. 4 silver candle holders, a wedding present from her brother, had disappeared from the china cabinet. Her antique jewelry box was nowhere to be found. Even in the kitchen, Chaz had expunged all traces. Where was the orchid that had hung in the window? Her coffee mug? The copper pot she'd bought for boiling his precious fucking spaghetti? It was as if she had never lived there, never been there, never existed. Joey took a steak knife from a drawer and stalked to the bedroom with the notion of slashing his new silk sheets, which smelled like they'd been laundered in stale sangria. Chaz, so particular about Joey's perfumes, evidently let his bimbos drench themselves with any maggot-gagging aroma that happened to be on sale. She raised the knife over her head, but that was as far as it got. This is pathetic, she thought, and not very original. She dropped the knife and flopped down on the bed, her side of the bed. She stared at the popcorn ceiling as she had hundreds of nights before, only now she felt like an intruder, which she was. She had to give Chaz credit. He had thoroughly erased her from the home that had once been theirs. Joey's shoulders started shaking, and her knees drew up, and she realized she was sobbing. It made her angry, no, furious, to be crying over a man who wanted her dead. Just stop it, she told herself. Stop right now. This isn't about losing Chaz. This is about pride and self-image and all that Dr. Phil crapola. How could my own husband come to hate me so much? What did I ever do to him? Nothing. This Joey stated aloud. Between sniffles. Not a damn thing. She sat up, dabbing at her eyes with the top sheet. So, to hell with Chaz Perrone. Joey slipped into the bathroom, wincing at her reflection, the puffy eyes and tear-streaked cheeks. She sat down to pee and to figure out what to do next. On the vanity there was a jumbo bottle of Maalox chewables, the sight of which buoyed her spirits. For Chaz, an ulcer would be excellent.